Shopomaniacs, you're listening to the final episode of the year of Shop Talk Show. I'm Dave Rubin. With me is Jingle Jingle Chris Coyer. Hey, Chris.
Hey.
Chris. Yeah. What's happening? It's the final episode, 392, I believe this is what this will be numbered, of the year. Wrapping up our eighth season here of the Shop Talk Show. Very exciting. We missed I don't know how the math works out, but we missed 400 by like eight episodes. That's too bad, huh?
Yeah. I wonder if we like never missed a single episode the entire time, we probably would have hit it. But once in a while, we skip an episode. Like, we're going to skip this one over
2 weeks off or something.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Maybe next year we'll take a little more time off over the holiday. I know I've said that before, but we'll see. Anyway, you know what I have on my calendar for January 1st? We had Lori Voss, who was at MPM at the time, who had all this data about usage of MPM, which was totally fascinating. And part of that data was like this massive rise of TypeScript that like everything is written in it and people are using it. And there's just like, there's like a surge like has never been seen before in a technology.
TypeScript apocalypse. Yeah. Type apocalypse.
Which is funny. I don't know. I don't know. The thing on my calendar was that by January 1st, Lori said that that React would be written in TypeScript, which I'm afraid that we're not going to hit that one. I don't think so, right? I mean, that's not...
I don't think so, but wasn't Lori saying, or maybe I'd heard it, that Redux is written in TypeScript. I know Vue is going to be written in TypeScript. Vue 3, I think.
That's cool.
Or at least, you know, it's tough. I get confused when I just skim the old headlines. When something adds TypeScript support, so like they, you know, I think as I understand it, you can supply like type definitions that TypeScript can like pick up on or something. And how that works is magic to me. But then there's a difference between just like adding type supporting TypeScript and then like being actually written in TypeScript.
Yeah, I don't quite understand it all either. I'm afraid I have to claim some ignorance here, but it does make me think of when there's new technologies in the world, I try to be aware of them, you know, and be like, where do they fall into the spectrum of building websites? When might I reach for it? But I never really grok it until I actually have a project that uses it, and then all the dominoes fall, and I'm like, oh, I get it. Wow, you know, like SAS was like that, and you know, any new CMS you pick up and JavaScript libraries are like that. You know, it's like you can kind of conceptually get it, and then you really get it when you actually like have a real project that requires that you use that technology. And it has never happened to me in TypeScript. I don't have any projects at all in TypeScript. So that like shoe has not dropped for me. But I did listen to a nice Tools Day episode the other week with
Tuesday. Is that their theme song? It's a musical podcast.
And they had a frank conversation about it, which was pretty interesting because there's like these real basics of TypeScript, like types. And you're like,
yeah,
okay, TypeScript has types. Like, I don't, when I'm working on my projects day to day, I'm not like, God, I really wish I could type these variables because every week we have bugs in our software that are a result of variables being of the wrong type. No, not really. Not that often. Like, that surely can't be the whole reason that TypeScript has blown up across the world is just types. Like, that doesn't seem to make sense to me. But they cover that and they're like, well, you know, that is actually some of it. But the bigger deal is that it adds, you know, because your IDE, like VS Code, can understand so much more about TypeScript because of its typed nature that it can be a lot more helpful as you write code. And this is particularly true with libraries, that when you use the functions of those libraries, that it can just be a lot more helpful in telling you what it expects as you use the functions of that library. And that seems like a big deal to me. And that doesn't have to be for, you know, third-party libraries. It could be just for functions that you declare yourself in your own app. You know, like, here's our little login function or whatever the function may be that takes these three things. Then when you go to call it, you know, like the, what do you call it, IntelliSense kicks in the app, and it starts being like, okay, this is what I want. Please give it to me correctly and in the right order and all that.
If I type like is active equals some, and if I defined it as a Boolean, true or false, it'll give me a drop down, true or false. It'll say like, oh, which one of these two options are you trying to?
Yeah.
Like, which is pretty cool.
So or if you, like, even if you don't like TypeScript, you might like it when other people write their stuff in TypeScript, because it certainly does make for a nicer author experience. And what's funny is that, how is this just a VS Code thing? I don't think I've seen it. Like, I don't know that if you're using like Sublime or Atom or something, that you get quite that level of integration.
Yeah, I think it's like a product that was honed for Visual Studio, big VS, mm-hmm. like big VS, not VS Code, this IntelliSense stuff. And then they managed to port it down to this kind of whatever, build your own IDE, not the big IDE for C#.net, you know? And it's really handy. I mean, there's a lot, and you can even experiment with types and TypeScript by, it's like, you like do a comment in your JavaScript and your, the enable, I forget the word, but, you can like experiment with types and kind of, it can sort of infer what you're trying to do too. Like it knows how to do that in VS Code already. Let me figure out, let me tell you, I have to do some Googling. This is too bad, but oh yeah. Okay. /@ts-check to any JavaScript, and it'll kind of infer what you're doing. And if you have JS documentations, like this is a parameter, @parameter string name or something like that, it'll know it's a string. And so if you start trying to say like, whatever, this dot name equals like,
okay,
false, it'll put a little, you know, red dot or whatever, a squiggly underline, and say, this is not valid. You said it was a string. So
meaning you can get some type, you can kind of baby step to TypeScript without having to like change your file extensions and change your file processing and all that.
Yeah. I'll put a little link in the show notes here, but it's just kind of this like little way to sort of experience what TypeScript might be like. I've worked on Angular projects that I've written in TypeScript. I think it's cool, but you know, I don't know. For me, it's a lot of action. It introduces a lot. But that said, I went on a bit of a code bender this weekend and made like two apps in Vue, and it was awesome. I was having a lot of fun just writing in CodePen. But there was a point where I was like, you know, it's like throwing. It's just like, this doesn't have a length, you know? And I'm like, why? It should have a length that's an array. You know, I said it as an array, but something must have been setting it to false or something like that. I don't remember what the exact answer was, but it was like, oh, okay. So I have to like set something. I have to make sure it's an array or else it'll just bomb out. So anyway, that was kind of, you know, that's what's weird about JavaScript. Like something can be false, zero, or an empty quote, and it's always and those are all the same interpreted value, you know, empty basically. So I think that's the problem.
I kind of want to be dragged into it at some point just to experience it. I was snake bitten once too. I worked on a little project, you know, that didn't get very far. It was kind of a hackathon kind of thing, where the original creator of the project was like, well, we're going to do this thing in like Next.js or something, but I want to do it all in TypeScript too. And it seemed like a little experimental-ish at the time to get TypeScript working with all the necessary other tools. So there was like wrappers and extra packages to make it all work. And I found it all really challenging, and that most of the time was like spent trying to kind of like shoehorn TypeScript into it all, to the point where, you know, I spent 80% of the time on that, couldn't really get it going, spent another 10% of the time ripping TypeScript all out of it because I just couldn't get it going. And then another 10% be like, well, I guess I'll do a little bit of work on this thing before just having to call it a day, to the point where then I was, you know, obviously after an experience like that, you're like, why? This was, you know, that was not.
What are
fun.
We doing here?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I think you have to be dragged in, or it's, for me, it's like a Webpack thing too. It's like, somebody had to set it up and for you. You're not just going to like parachute from the sky and be like ready to use it, you know, like getting it going from the ground up. I don't know that it's that intuitive for me. There is some data to suggest, and I've read like research papers from Microsoft. I was going to try to find it again. I'm live Googling, but there's something like having strong types in a language like JavaScript can basically reduce like 15% of bugs. Like it catches 15% of all bugs. So, you know,
I buy it.
Yeah. And so I, for Dave Rupert, you know, where I have zero bugs, that doesn't mean anything. but if, you know, I don't know, if you're working on a team and you're regularly like, whatever, the whole system's crashing. And that's the thing about JavaScript too, is like it hits an error and it's like, dude, sorry, we're gone. We left. We peaced out. Everything's broken. Shut it down. And so like,
I wonder if it reduces the need for it with optional chaining now. Just put a question mark after literally everything.
See? Yeah. Undefined. Are you undefined?
Doesn't
you
undefined? Matter.
Is everybody? Sorry. Question period is the new period. So that'll be it, dude. That's it. That's a t-shirt. We should get on the old, that new web dev t-shirt company that Adios Money
worked. It's almost on. Kind of true, though. Like, you almost put question mark before almost everything, you know, why not kind of thing? At least it won't break. I don't know. Remember there was a call for when backticks came out, there was a little bit of a campaign for like, just only use them. They're just better in all circumstances. Even if you're just saying, you know, quote Dave, like use backticks. Just give yourself the muscle memory of it because it's just better.
It is. I use them in like query selectors and stuff like that. Man. Yeah. Like, or like jQuery, I'll use a backtick, whatever. It doesn't care. It can work. So it's
the only time I don't like seeing it is in React code when, you know, you could have wrote just like, I don't know, data name equals quote Dave. That people go like data name equals curly bracket backtick Dave backtick curly bracket. You know, you're like you invoked JavaScript just to use backticks. You know, you're like maybe that's one step too far.
You broke out of JSX to use JavaScript to just echo a variable. Hey man, websites are complicated.
Hey there, this episode is brought to you by WordPress.com. Whether you want to share your ideas, start a business, or run a store, you can do it all on WordPress.com. Maybe you're like me and you've set up a lot of self-hosted WordPress sites over the years. And it's great that WordPress gives you that option, but sometimes you don't want to have to worry about servers, infrastructure, backups, and cron jobs. You just want to start a website now, and that's why you should check out WordPress.com. You can open a store, process payments, configure taxes and shipping, build a marketing plan. You make the widgets, they'll help you make the website. You can start a blog, make your mark online with the world's greatest blogging tool, and join a community millions strong that's waiting to hear what you have to say. You could design a portfolio. Thousands of themes means there's a layout that's just right for you, while storage and design options ensure you can upload anything you need and give your work the stage it deserves. You could build a fan base, promote your products, use advanced statistics and SEO tools, and connect with built-in audiences on social media to grow your business. You can start it all today on WordPress.com for free. Whether you want to create, share, or sell, do it right on WordPress.com. Our thanks to WordPress.com for sponsoring this episode of Shop Talk Show.
Well, we got a bunch of questions. Should we do some?
We do have some questions.
Let's do some of that, and then we can sprinkle in some 2019, 2020 talk if we want. If there's any standout stuff, that'd be cool. But here's one from Michael Reed. Speaking of JavaScript stuff, is it worth using a JavaScript bundler for a WordPress or CMS site? The company I work for uses a large enterprise CMS, and the JavaScript for that site is just a minified mash of several different JavaScript files, most of which are several hundred lines of spaghetti code. Been there, buddy. Would it be nice to break these files up into smaller modules, as well as have the benefit of adding Babel for writing more modern JS, but the bundled JavaScript that kind of like Webpack or Parcel or Rollup spits out seems massive. Won't that bundled file, you know, hurt the performance of the site? This feels very up my alley right now. I just published my gulp file because I was just like cleaning up, you know, some gulp processing I was doing on CSS Tricks. CSS Tricks is not a React site or a Vue site or anything. It's a pretty standard grade WordPress site. It has some JavaScript on it, though, for like, I need to like click the hamburger menu open and open it, or I need to do some syntax highlighting, or I need to fetch some ads and display them on the site. Okay, cool. You know, like, so I need some JavaScript to do that. And I still use jQuery because, you know, jQuery is bundled with a bunch of WordPress plugins. It feels pretty natural fit these days. So,
sorry, am I wrong? Like, jQuery happens by default. Like, you have to unset it, right? To in a WordPress site, or do you have to enqueue it?
On the front end, you know, like, you're 90% of the sites you're going to get it because something's going to trigger it. Like, a Jetpack thing is going to trigger it or something. I don't think it necessarily 100% of the time gets added, but like, anything in its sister will trigger it to be added.
Okay. Okay, okay.
You know, so I use that, and I have my spaghetti code too, although I keep it, you know, kind of modular. I like my main global.js file that's responsible for 80% of the functionality is somewhat well organized, but I just kind of have it in a big object and, you know, call the functions that I need and stuff. It's not total spaghetti, but it's a little spaghetti. But then I got, you know, FitVids in there, and I got PrismJS, and I got, you know, okay, there's two examples. Neither of those are ES6 ready. Sorry. I don't think you ever got around to making FitVids.
How dare you? hey, there, I'll give you a little hint, okay?
Yeah.
On my gist page, there is a vanilla version of FitVids you have to copy and paste and put in your own damn site because I'm not maintaining an NPM module ever in my whole life ever again. So
no, there you go. Fair enough. You know, so there's probably four or five JavaScript files, none of which just happen to not be importable. You know, classic ES6 style kind of. So I can't write my global.js file with a bunch of import statements at the top of it and run it through Babel and Webpack and have it just all smashed together that way that we're used to working on so many other projects. It's just not available to me. You know, I still run Babel over it, but I just run Babel over it individually, you know, so I can use optional chaining and stuff like that if I really care to. But then I need something else to smash them all together, so I use Gulp. I just, old school style, be like, okay, process them all with Babel, minify them, smash them together just with bespoke instructions. So part of that makes me feel like, all right, well, that sucks. You know, maybe in the future that could be cooler, or maybe I'll use Gatsby to build the site next time and just go full bore crazy. You know, like, probably not, but maybe. Yeah, anyway, that's just the world that, you know, I get where, Michael, you're coming from, and that, you know, this like Babel, Webpack, JavaScript bundling type of stuff kind of doesn't fit with, you know, CMS-y type of builds sometimes, just because of like the tools in use, you know, in a way.
WordPress is interesting because to update WordPress, like, you can do it all locally, but I imagine most people are still just like click the blue button that updates WordPress when it asks you to, you know? And so like that all happens. All the content is done online. You don't pull down any of the content, or you don't have to, you know? But it's that theme development that happens locally or whatever. And that's what powers the site. That's what gets the e-commerce working. That's what does all that, you know? And you know, he's saying several hundred lines of spaghetti code. I mean, I think that's easy to achieve, you know? I think, you know, there's nothing to say like you can't use like WP and Q scripts for all your dependencies, I guess, and just let WordPress or whatever kind of minifier bundler you have on WordPress minify those things. But then the code you write, like, that can be tiny, that can be split up and written into, you know, using Parcel or something like that. The output is, I wouldn't worry about it. I mean, it is like, you are smashing together like five files, so you need to like pay attention to what you're doing there. But, you know, I've had good luck with Parcel and Rollup, like just getting something going that bundles files. It can do the tree shaking and stuff like that. But I think if you're doing that, you're in a weird position with WordPress specifically, is like, now how do you map that to like each view, the file it generated to each view? Like, you know, single dot 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. How are you going to get that uploaded to your single template or whatever, your global, your, I forget what the names are, like main and like whatever. Like if you're splitting the code, now you're responsible for getting it in, but you could also just do the thing where that code loads late or like async or something like that. So you just get it to spit out the files, the chunks, and then maybe you deal with the chunks. I don't know. That's where it gets tricky, because then there's caching involved in all that too. So
I'm a little, it confuses me how it all works. For example, if you just had an index.js file and you wrote const x equals 2 in it, and then you're just like, okay, here you go, webpack this thing.
Yeah.
You get, in my experience here, 8,912 lines of code. And at the very bottom of it, it says use strict, you know, var x equals 2. But the whole top of it is like all this like stuff for dealing with modules and packages and requires. And you ever seen this? It like blows my mind in a way that.
Yeah. I mean, that's the modern world. I mean, like, I think I was reading, there's a good Perf Planet, which they do like a advent calendar kind of thing. But it was just about the cost of React and CSS and JS and stuff like that. And it was just saying like every CSS and JS library is about 20K of overhead, like just from the functions that get it, inject it,
that sounds recalc about right. All
the classes and stuff like that. So on the client, that's going to cost you 20K. So yeah, I hope
not from a library, but from the bundler.
You know, I think there's some unseen performance costs is what the article is called. So, so, you know, some of this stuff isn't free. So, okay, CSS and JS is 12 to 15K or something. And then in this article, they're advocating for Linea. Is that, are you familiar with that library? It's kind of a slight alternative to like what the CSS and JS are doing. It's kind of more like, it's more, it doesn't work on IE9 or IE11 because it uses CSS variables to do all the manipulating. So it may not work for your system, but they're advocating for it because it's only like 2K on the client or something like that. So,
okay.
3K. So.
There's just something funky with the processing I've got set up. It's so much more extreme than that. This little, I sent you this little project that's like, it makes one line of code into unminified or anything. 328K. That can't be right. There's something.
Whoa.
Don't listeners, don't worry about it too much. I'll dig into that.
We have processed the world. Yeah, this is wild, dude. What happened? I mean, that's the thing too, is Webpack has dependencies, so it imports all those things and blah blah blah. And so, and then it all bundles up and spits out something. So maybe some of those bundles aren't even, you know, I don't know.
Whatever, this is perennial stuff. What is JavaScript doing to us? If you know, that's probably was a hot topic in 2019, but I think it was kind of a hot topic in 2018 too. You know, like this will be continued to be a hot topic because people care. They're always caring about performance and accessibility and stuff. I would say as we head into 2020, I don't see a particular surge in it above and beyond any other cert. I think when you're in an optimistic mood, you're like, yeah, we're doing better at performance. When you're in a pessimistic mood, you're like, no, we're not. And the same with, performance.
I have a post like about this. It's just, I always feel like I was doing good. And then I like ran web page tests easy on my site and it was taking 33 seconds to load. And I just was like, what? Like 33 seconds. And I care about it. What the hell's going on? And it was just, I was loading my fonts bad, basically.
In 33 seconds, meaning like a slow 3G mobile connection.
Yeah. That's the only way to test. You're kidding yourself if you do otherwise.
Yeah.
Hard mode only.
And then is that like, you know, DOM ready or window.load, or is that your first meaningful paint?
I think that was full load, but yeah, I forget what the actual stats are. I could pull it up. Or
there's always interesting new perf stats, right? Like this year dropped us a couple of new performance stats. One of them was an interesting one about it would try to find like the largest, like meaningful looking element on the page. Yeah, was that the meaningful paint one, or it was often an image? It was like, you know, obviously this image is important to the page and takes up a lot of screen real estate. So when that thing paints, then that's your metric, because that's the thing that matters to people, which is a little bit different than like the first rendering pass. Although that one matters too, because that's the moment from like white to something, you know, and something certainly is like a pivotal moment in the feeling of loading a website.
Yeah. Yeah. You almost need like the three in tandem, like first paint, like when did it get stuff and it could paint to pixel, you know? And when did it like paint stuff and the user could read it? And then these are, now it gets into the time to interactive. Like, I actually don't care about load so much as like time to interactive. Like, when can the user scroll the page or click the search bar? You know, I mean, you see it on The Verge all the time. Like, if you ever go to that website and then try to search, it takes a good like 25 seconds, even on like Fiverr, to like get the actual like,
gosh, that's like, too bad.
Search UI is going. So yeah, you got to like think about that stuff. No offense to people who work on Verge. I'm sure you're working very hard and advertisements are against you, but, for bundling, I was on the search for like, what is the easiest way to bundle? And I landed on like parcel. Like, mm-hmm. I have just a one line NPM script that parses my JS and spits it up.
That's kind of its promise, isn't it? I'm intrigued by it in a way. I considered it because it's, you know, you could almost possibly think of it as a gulp alternative. So as I set up to write this gulp file, I was like, I guess with Parsley, you don't have to write anything at all because it looks at, for example, a template file and it says like, oh, I see they're loading up an SCSS file here. So I guess I better process that for them. And they're loading up this JavaScript file. I guess I better process that for them. But in a sense, it's like you're punting your configuration to a template then. And it made me feel a little uneasy to put like .css in a link, you know, like, ooh, like that doesn't.
Yeah. And I will say like similar to your like, oh, this Webpack spit out 8,000 lines of code, which that seems like weird and wrong, but we'll just say that's the fact. Cause you verified it, you showed it to me. So it's real.
I know.
But the like bundle that's like spitting out here, you know, it starts off with a parcel require function, you know, and let's see, my bundle is 33K and I'm really not using a super hell of a lot of JavaScript per the usual. I like literally, here, I'll tell you what's going in there. I guess I have 1, 2, 3, 4 polyfills and then like 2 tiny jQuerys and Prism, like you said, I guess Prism's 20K. So that's a big chunk of the like total 33K or whatever. So anyway, it's interesting what goes in and what goes out. There's tools like Source Map Explorer. Have you used that? It's similar to like Webpack Bundle Analyzer.
It's looking at your actual code, not your packages.
Kind of doesn't care if you use SAS or if you use a Webpack or whatever. It just looks at a source map. You compare a file to a source map and it'll like spit out a tree graph, which is kind of these like boxes inside boxes, and it'll show you what's inside of that bundle. So anyway, it's pretty cool.
That is cool.
But anyway, maybe I should write a CSS tricks post, man. This is maybe the easiest way to process JavaScript. Cause I really like, I'm very like minimalist, or like, I didn't want to overcommit and make some big gigantic Webpack flow like, and then, you know, we go to a client and they're like, oh, we're on gulp 3 or whatever. It's like, oh shoot. Like, okay, we'll switch it. You know, like I didn't want to overbuy into like something.
Is there like some, we covered that Prism is not, you can't import Prism from Prism. It's not ready for that. So how did you deal with that in parcel land? Does it have like comment directives or something? That's like,
no, it just, it like can, let me tell you what it does here. Prism.
You just link up a bunch of scripts at the bottom of your template.
Or? Yeah. Basically like calls it like a function, like A equals the Prism object or whatever. So once it's in there, it can like negotiate, like it's just part of the big bundle. It's like, it's sucked up like you did it with a gulp file basically. Mm. So it's kind of the hybrid of gulp and like a.
So you just call kind of Prism globally?
Here's my command. npm run process colon js. That's what I called it, right? Mm-hmm. And then that runs parcel build source assets js app.js, which has all my imports and.
Yeah. So what's it? So at the top of app.js, does it call Prism or something?
Yeah, I just have import in app.js and it comes in.
So you can import Prism.
Well, yeah, I mean, it might be cheating, but yeah. So like maybe it's not doing it right, but it's just saying like pull in these scripts, you know, like, but I have it as like prism.js, like I'm importing the whole file, not just the.
Oh, maybe that's how it maybe. Yeah. Okay. Because what you can do that, right? It's not a named import. You're just saying like, just give me this whole file, please.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because I do nothing with it. And I just, and it auto executes or whatever.
You could probably teach Webpack how to do that too, right? So that's the beauty of a bundler in a way. It's like bundlers follow ES6 import style, but only because they can, right? But bundlers have extra abilities, right? Like when you write import React from React, that's not ES6. That's special, weird syntax that just happens to work with bundlers, and bundlers just happen to agree that when you write that, that means please grab that from my node modules folder. But that's just like a handshake agreement with how bundlers work, right? So so your import statement also is not ES6 friendly. It's just like, it's just a line of code that bundlers happen to understand because of some handshake agreement that that's how bundlers, this bundler is going to work.
Yeah, and I think it's sort of just like the node style of importing, like common JS sort of style, you know, require. Okay. You could probably use require too.
Right.
Like it's just sort of like require this file and do something with it. Like, so yeah, I mean, maybe it's totally hacking around it, but no, that's how I do it. So, it's pretty good. And then you say like outdir equals source JS and outfile is bundle.js and then it's done. And it gives me a source map too.
But I would, so my thinking here then is that that app.js file is like a little bit ties you to parcel, just a smidgel. It's not totally friendly to, you couldn't just stop using.
Parcel. Yeah. I mean, I guess so. Like, I mean, I think it would, yeah, I guess you're right. I mean, I don't know how you'd get around that. I mean, like, you just have, if something's not modularized, I mean, you need, I think we're going to be in that situation for a long time where some code is like, you know, not modules and some is, you know, for a long time. So
probably, yes, quite a long time. There already is I feel like we're almost, you know, past peak people begging for people to rewrite their libraries to be import friendly, you know, and it's not even solved yet. I think that's what isn't that the promise of Pika or whatever is like, this problem sucks. So like, we'll just deal with it for you.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but Pika has a hard requirement for modules. Like, it has like, you have to,
oh, it's gotta be ES6E and then it helps you. Oh, wow. Well, yeah. That's not that helpful then.
Yeah, I think they have like some cheater scripts because not like preact or something can't do it or something, you know, like, so they like cheat it or something like that. But yeah, it's sort of this idea of like, it, if in npm package land, you can do module colon my file, you know, like there's like a, what is it in npm? It's like main index.js or whatever. Like you set in your package.json, you set a main file and that's where everything will look for the JavaScript to start. And then it also has a module directive now or whatever, a property in the JSON package.json that you can set to whatever your module is. So index.mjs or whatever. And that will, I think Pika picks up on repos that have that. And then it can kind of like build out a thing. So if you say like, I want preact, it'll like go get all the stuff it needs for preact and give you just one file. So
that's cool.
Yeah. And then I found out the other day, unpackaged, you can like do like question mark module or something and it'll trigger the module.
Yeah, it's been like years that's been like kind of in beta or whatever, because it depends on if it's able to do it or not, and I don't know what
some of that stuff I just don't get. So like that's a big project, so I'm just like, how do you do this?
I mean, it'd be nice if I don't really understand how it works either, but there's stuff on npm that you know, you can't use in the browser. It's just, you have to run it. It's like a required thing or whatever. But wouldn't it be nice if every single thing on NPM was available to use in the browser in some, through some magic, you know? So that would kind of be a ticket there if you're like, okay, force this lib to be in modules so then I can import it. And then I wouldn't even need to run Webpack or whatever. I can just ES6 import it, you know? That like opens some doors. Anyway, we're still in the throes of working on that at CodePen, actually. You know, like,
yeah.
If I take this lib and we run it through Webpack, we can learn a bunch of interesting stuff about it. Like, you try to use React DOM, you know, there has a peer dependency of React. So, but you only really know that if you actually try to like process code in it. So then we can go get React for you and bundle it all together and make it work in a way. Because you'd think that, you know, libs depend on a bunch of other libs. And so you'd think you'd have to get that right in your package.json, but you kind of don't. It's the package.json is kind of like a suggestion of what its dependencies are. But until you process that code, then you really learn what the dependencies are. Then you can get the real dependencies.
Oh, man. Well, and even like source or dev dependencies and you know, dependencies, right? Like, I have SAS in my dependencies folder on this one project. And I'm like, maybe that's a dev dependency, I think, you know? But then it's like, but if I move it there, does Netlify do the dev dependencies or do they just do the dependencies? What does Netlify care?
Probably just dependencies, but they probably have this problem all the time. And so they don't trust you. I bet it works on Netlify because they don't trust you to have it right.
Yeah, they're basically like, this guy does not know what he's doing. We will install both. So,
probably. I can't say that that's for sure the case, but it sounds about right to me.
But maybe this line is getting weird too. Like, or maybe, you know, I think dependencies was supposed to be more for like, you know, I don't know, like you, this was code that would end up in Browserify or something like that, you know, but. Like, dev dependencies, like, was supposed to be, like, only for development environment, but this is going to production, so what do I do? So
that's what it was supposed to be. And then peer dependencies, yeah, just good luck trying to explain that.
I'll move it to dependent. So hopefully that helped. Not, it probably didn't help, but I've had good luck with Parcel. So try that, Michael. It's a one-liner. Should be pretty good to just do. Like, I just Parcel build input file, outdir and outfile. That's what I use. So, and I get pretty good results. Who knows what's in there, but pretty good results.
This episode is brought to you by GiveWell. Imagine that you want to help children. You found two trustworthy organizations, but they run different programs. One can save a child's life for every $300,000 donated, while the other can save a child's life for every $3,000 donated. If you could tell the difference, you'd donate to the one that was 100 times better at saving children's lives. But in reality, it's often hard to know what charities will actually be able to accomplish with your donation. GiveWell spends 20,000 hours each year researching charities. They review academic studies, charity budgets, and visit charities on the ground to figure out which ones are the best at saving or improving lives. All of their research is public and free on their website. Go to givewell.org/shoptalk to find out more or make a donation. First-time donors will have their donation matched up to $1,000 if they donate through givewell.org/shoptalk. Our thanks to GiveWell for sponsoring this episode.
Okay, Alan Reeder, no relation to Michael Reed. Just read it. Chris recently blogged about parallax breaking in iOS 13. I'm working up a tasteful parallax experience for a client and just discovered that Apple are being quack in breaking the web. Is there any point in trying to do parallax then? Chris, is parallax dead?
Well, I mean, that's extreme because what I blogged was that there's one particular way that you can do parallax in CSS in which that you, you know, I don't know, you basically use like a Z translate, a 3D translate to kind of push an element away from the screen. You can imagine that, right? Like a div, and this one's set further back than another one
this
is.
This one's 1,000, this one's 300, it's up in my face.
Yeah, and now when you scroll, the one that's further back, you know, it scrolls a little slower because it's further away. That's what parallax is. It's like you're driving down the road and the fence right on the side of the road is moving fast, but the barn in the distance is moving slow. And because you've pushed this element back, like the barn, it moves slow. You know, which is fine. You can actually leave it like that, and that's still parallax, I'd say. But sometimes parallax is thought of as like, well, let's, you know, what if there's text on the side of this? Let's like bring it back to the forefront so that different things are scrolling at different speeds, but they're not necessarily sized differently. Then you can use a scale to bring it back up to the regular size that it was before you did the transform, or somewhere in between, or whatever you want, you know? So now, yes, CSS parallax going on. As you scroll up and down the page, different elements are scrolling at different speeds. That, you know, what was it, Keith Clark maybe blogged that in like 2012 or 11 or something? Yeah, made it in SAS, did it great. It doesn't work anymore in iOS 13 and Safari, and that, which means it doesn't work in Chrome and Firefox on iOS either, because they all use the same rendering engine on iOS. That's a whole hot topic recently. Anyway, a little bit of a bummer, right? Like, what the hell? I also noticed there's the, you know, I don't know if I've mentioned this on the show recently. One of my favorite CSS tricks, or literally like not my site, but CSS tricks of all time is this one that Lee Avrue kind of popularized, of this like using four shadows, some of them with background attachment local and some of them with background attachment scroll, on an element that like shows a shadow if you can scroll in that direction. And then once you've maxed out your scrolling in that direction, the shadow goes away and it works both directions. It's really clever. And I think a nice UX touch too, because it's nice to indicate to a user when you can scroll in a direction and when you're at maximum scroll there without necessarily seeing a scroll bar. So on mobile, it's particularly useful. And in fact, I read an article recently about somebody's mom, you know, I know that's a terrible cliche, but the mom could not find some very important action in like the sharing panel of iOS. And it all, you know, and it was really weird because, you know, the kid it was helping could find it easily and whatever. But it all boiled down to the way that the sharing panel was laid out had some options that you could scroll down to, but there is no element that was like half cut off or anything. Like a half cut off element is a good cue that you can scroll to see the rest of it, but it was designed perfectly so that you couldn't see any. There was no indication that you could scroll whatsoever. Well, if there's a little subtle shadow there, you could do it. My point is, whatever technique that thing uses, it's broken in the same way on iOS 13. iOS 13 is doing some pre-rendered layer thing for performance reasons, surely, that makes all these techniques not work. Like it paints it and then it won't repaint it, you know, like it used to. So it's broke. They literally broke it, you know? And you know, some people are saying like, oh, well, those aren't stable specs. You know, there's no promises to be made. If something works for like 7-8 years on the web, it doesn't matter what the state of the spec is. Like that's an established thing. Like you broke it. You broke it.
Well, maybe in 2020, it will get a fix.
I mean, that's why I wanted to blog about it and make a stink about it, because it's like, you can't just go around, hey, you know, Blue Beanie Day, you know, yeah. Freaking Zeldman just blogged this. It's like on the decline a little bit, you know, but to me, it always meant like, not so much like, let's celebrate web standards or fight for what, you know, it was kind of like a reminder, you know, because I was kind of later in the game anyway. You know, I think the early days of Blue Beanie Day were very much like, you know, web standards, like, I don't know, I can't describe the meaning of it perfectly, but I always thought it meant like, let's stay vigilant about web standards instead of ignoring it. And so this is an example of staying vigilant, you know, like you broke something, please fix it.
Yeah. No, I mean, how many marketing sites just took a dump right here? I mean, even Apple's own sites use a lot of parallax. Yeah. I can't imagine that made it through the QA system. I mean, you know, they like all their sites. Yeah. All their sites never use that one technique. That's wild. So.
Oh, maybe they do. I'm not sure. But you know, I'd say most parallax, Alan, is done with JavaScript. It's done with scroll position and intersection observer and stuff like that. There's a bunch of different kind of meanings of parallax and how it's implemented. This was just one way So don't take my writing as all parallax in the entire world is broken. It's just this one way. But it happens to be a good way. So, you know, that bugs me a little.
Yeah. I was going to say I have a blog post on my site. I'll do a link to myself called Cheap Ass Parallax. And it's basically, it uses CSS variables to sort of set a scroll amount as you scroll. And it'll kind of... you can fake these kind of slow dropping effects pretty easy with like six lines of code. So it made it, I don't know, that was about like for the same reasons I would probably use the CSS thing. Like, oh, it's just less code and it's, you know, it's not some big 20 megabyte library. That's great. And what's cool is you can like also like have a fallback for IE11 where everything's in the right position. And this one, you're just like, okay, now use the variables, you know?
Yeah, it's nice. It's an undebounced window scroll listener. That's kind of funny how we kind of care less about that over time.
Yeah, it's debounced. And, you know, it's that thing where if you use like translate, you get a little more performance out of, you know, just because of the compositing and stuff like that. So, you know, you could even, you know, I don't know what the rules are exactly, but you could use the passive scroll listener too, like comma.
Yeah, I hear that suggested regularly. What does that mean, really? Is it just like...
It's kind of like request idle call... How I describe it is like request idle callback plus scroll. Mm. So it's not, it's like I'm going to do... And I think the idea is you're not like recalculating layout on every piece of scroll, which maybe I still am because I do like query like document scroll top or something like that. But the idea is like you're okay with it being like called maybe not on right as the event fires or whatever. Does that make sense?
Like, yeah. So
it's, maybe it's I'm explaining to, it bad, but
I wonder if it will run all of them anyway, or if it's willing to drop a few.
I think it could maybe drop a few. I'm not sure, but yeah, I could probably see here.
Oh, it looks like somebody did it with request animation frame too, huh? So if you really cared, you could do that.
Yeah. No, totally. I mean, there's other like ways to do it too. Yeah. Request animation frame would be cool. Just because it's like you just wait and the browser will tell you when it's ready to do it. So
yeah, you have a fork of it in your own blog post on how to do it. It's turned 6 lines to 10 lines. Big deal.
But yeah, anyway, it's check it out. I think that might bail you out of your problem. So
is there any other 2019 things that you feel like were typified the year?
Well, 2019, I guess, like, you did your end of year series here. Mm-hmm. The what I'm excited about sort of series, right?
Yeah, it was kind of like what's got your attention this year on CSS Tricks. We got about a little over 20 authors kind of answering the question of what about building websites has you interested this year, you know, and I kind of, the subtext was like in a positive way, you know, I didn't want it to all be, I don't know, dunking on the world of tech just because there's a lot of that already. And I think we just, whatever that for my spin for this series is like, what's got your attention in a positive way?
No, I liked it. And, I felt like a lot of people were, like, hey, the tools are actually pretty good. Like, which is kind of interesting because for the longest time, you know, web development's been like, we had tools like Dreamweaver, but they like spit out really terrible code. So you're like, ah, this is terrible, you know, or, you know, Drupal, everything was in a table for a while there, you know? But I feel like we're kind of at a place where we have some good tools. And even on the design side, we have tools that are rendering more web-ish now. So I think that's like a big deal. That was one thing I got out of that series. But
I like that. That's a great typification of this series. Like that, you know, Scott Jahl's article was directly about that, but there's more going on of that. There's a lot of Jamstack talk with the idea that Jamstack is just kind of like a good idea. And so it's a tool that, you know, gives us a lot. And it's here, so use it, you know. And Rachel Andrew talking about how CSS slowly now has given us a real system. It's not this kind of tower of hacks that, if you felt like that was the case in the past, is moved its way out of that. And it's going to be more and more true over the next few years as things that we can use logical properties more, and we can use, you know, if you're still a holdout on grid, that we can use. And so it's becoming this much more cohesive system of like laying out rectangles on a page in a very logical way, almost totally free of hacks. Like that tool has arrived, you know. The CDN tools have arrived, and our ability to kind of manipulate HTML in good ways are here. And, you know, the extending CSS has arrived, and these variable fonts are so amazing. They've arrived. And, you know, Ruth John talking about how, you know, all this hackery we had to do with values in JavaScript because they tend to be strings. Well, there's the type object model now. That's arrived. And there's so many, like, this stuff has arrived. Use it, you know?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's like, I even think, you know, like, grid is here. Like, layout's so friggin' easy. And, like, subgrid just hit Firefox, like, last week or whatever. Like, that's going to make layouts even more better, you know? Like, grid gap is, or flex gap is coming to Flexbox. I don't know when that's ever happening, but that's coming. And that's going to make Flexbox, like, actually great. So like, man, we're so close, you know. And even smooth scrolling, or I mean, Netlify is a huge one for me. It's like, man, all my deployment is, I just get, and then it's deployed, and then I don't have to, like, you know, it's just done. Like, and I get a little CI out of it, and I'm gonna like start playing with Netlify plugins or build plugins to like see if I can like do some more cool stuff as I build a site, you know. That's cool stuff. I just, the tools, or even accessibility, man. It used to be very hard to even figure out your accessibility on your site, but now you have Axe, like, in the browser, in DevTools, in every Lighthouse report, and it just tells you what's going on. Lighthouse will tell you every, like, the latency of every single third-party script on your website. Like, that's huge for me, for clients, stuff like that. Like, I can walk in and just be like, you know, that user replay, that's adding like 4 minutes to your website or whatever. Like, that's very cool stuff. The tools are here, or like getting better all the time. You know, I don't, did we have somebody pitching us on like a no code talk or something? I feel like we did. That's okay if it was you. You know, I don't know that we're like full no code web flow yet, or like that's the future, but like, I'd be curious. I don't know. I mean, it seems like a lot of tools are here and making it a lot easier to do stuff. So,
well, good eye there. I think that's very true with all this. I tried to get one of my own for the series and didn't quite make it. I was too busy.
What was yours going to be? Editing. You got spoilers?
Well, I don't know that I landed on a perfect topic, but I think I am going to publish one just about the, like, kind of asking the, you know, a different question, which is, has all this gotten easier or harder? Is building websites easier or harder than it was, say, 10 years ago? Is the bar higher or lower? And then kind of like trying to explore that idea a little bit, it, you know, with the idea that I am interested in that. Like, that's highly interesting to me. And that I kind of have some evidence both ways of things like CSS getting so much easier, but things like HTML really is a wash. You know, it's not any easier or not. But then, like, those are just really base technologies. Does that actually help you get a website up live from nothing? You know, not really. Like, of course, you can just use HTML and CSS to build a website, but dang near nobody does. You know, it's all about tooling around that. So, like, what's that world like? Are those tools easier or harder to use? And then, like, just because there are some easy things out there, do people actually use them en masse? Are they marketed in a way that people know about them? Like, what are people actually doing? You know, and I don't know that I have answers to that. It's just fun to think about, you know. I'd think like spinning up an average WordPress site, you know, is such a common thing to do. I want a self-hosted WordPress site. I don't think it's dramatically easier or harder than it was 10 years ago. It's just wild to me.
Yeah. Well, Delicious Brains had a tool kind of for that, but
they did, but it's, no, it's pretty developer focused tool though. You know, I don't think they would disagree in a way, but yeah. I know what you mean.
Well, and a lot of the world too is going, I mean, Squarespace and Wix and stuff too. I mean, I think that's cut out a huge chunk of the like potential websites, but also for good. I mean, like you do those when you're young and or eager, which that maybe is a problem because it like cuts young and eager people out of the industry a bit. But it was a lot of work to like, okay, now I got to maintain this big WordPress site for this client, even though like they don't have money. And then, you know, so, WordPress and or Squarespace and those sort of sites are, you know,
that is easier like, than it was 10 years ago. That is significant. Those choices are the, like, just, I don't know, just click a few buttons and have a website. There's no doubt that that's easier and people are doing it. For sure. Yeah. So to that degree, to go from zero to website with a tool that wants to hand it all to you, there's no doubt about that. That's gotten easier.
Yeah. I think of like my small business owner, you know, it used to be like some guy with a stack of paper files, you know, like a Glengarry Glen Ross or whatever, like just a analog man, you know, and I need a website to make my life better. But now my like vision of a person who needs a website is like a Twitch streamer. It's like somebody who's like, I just played video games on the internet all day. And now I have a business. I make ads, I sell ads, and I have like an online presence. And then people wanted me to go to conferences to talk and they need a contact point. And you know, those are like, they probably have a Twitch page, but they probably need like a website. Like Ninja needs a website for some reason. So like, what do you, you know, that's interesting to me. Like there's different kinds of small businesses now, even from when I started out, but like, you know, it's almost like websites are getting personal. Influencers need a website of some kind maybe, but you know, it's, those are weird jobs. But anyway, that's like my vision of like who needs a website. Small businesses still need a website. Like I just took a bunch of paper to get shredded and buy a paper shredder and they needed a better website. So there's a lot of websites that need improved.
Let's wrap up a little final WordPress question here, just so we mentioned it anyway.
Okay. Last one.
Yeah, Martin. I work on a site that, you know, a client site that runs WordPress. We use templates for most things, but I frequently get asked to build bespoke pages, like a mini sales page or an FAQ page, you know, that's totally bespoke from the rest of the templates. Sometimes using the Gutenberg editor suffices, but for larger pages, I write them up from HTML and CSS from scratch in an editor or whatever, get it how I like it, and then I paste it into Gutenberg and hit convert to blocks. I'm thinking there must be a better way to do this. I wish I could find some kind of templating system where I can create custom blocks components and reuse them throughout the page or even across different pages. I'm currently learning Svelte, yada, yada, yada. That's probably not going to happen in the Gutenberg editor. So, I mean, yeah, okay. Wants to make bespoke templates using Gutenberg. And the way they do it right now is just like drop some chunks of HTML in there, which is a pretty interesting approach.
Yeah. Like, so
it's certainly easier than writing a Gutenberg block from scratch with React and all that stuff. Like, that's, I don't see a ton of people dipping their toes in that. Like, I just need a custom block. So I'm going to write an entire Gutenberg plugin to do it. Not so much.
I may be way off. But in WordPress, you can do like, you can make pages like, what was the example? Mini sales dash HTML.php or whatever. Like mini sales template or like mini sales 2019.html and or .php. And you can like write code for it. And it's pretty well documented what it was for just by the file name.
Right.
You know, you can do that. You don't have to use the Gutenberg editor.
I do that all the time. That's, I don't know if that's old school or what, but that's how I did this series. In fact, I think it worked out tremendously well. You need an FAQ page, make a page called page-faq.php, throw it in your theme, throw the comment at the top of it that says, this is a page template and this is its name. Publish the page, pick it from the drop-down menu. Now you have a PHP file in your theme that is totally customizable however the hell you want it to be, which is great, I think.
You could chuck in some custom fields or some blocks if you need to customize something, products or whatever. So that's how I would do it.
But it does mean you're writing code and you're not editing it from the editor then. I mean, there is like a theme editor in there that you could do stuff. But I wonder if the reason he doesn't do that is because I'm like, well, I want to be able to edit this page from the editor. You know, so I wonder if that's where this Gutenberg thing comes in. It makes me think about, you know, like there's like in a WordPress theme, there's like the content, which is just like bleh, it blap, it just barfs out whatever's in the, you know, the main content field of a post or page. And that's usually what I think of as that's where Gutenberg lives. Like it's not really a page builder because in your templates, all the Gutenberg stuff just gets output just in whatever column you have set up for the content. But I wonder if you could, like, it might be kind of cool, or if people are actually doing this, maybe they already are, and I don't know, is to make, like, a page template like we just described for an FAQ page or something, but just call it, like, totally blank Gutenberg canvas that it's a page mm-hmm. template, and all it does is output the content. That's it. There's no header, footer, nothing, you know? And then you build, and it's just a full width thing. And you build the whole page with Gutenberg blocks that way. That would be kind of cool, you know?
Oh, man, there's a Gutenberg custom HTML block. I don't know. Maybe that's it. I don't know. Hey, I don't know.
But I get the point where it's like, then you make a block that you want that's pretty custom. Then what? You know, like you just did it once because it's just HTML, you know? I wouldn't doubt that there's some plugin out there that's like, make a block in Gutenberg to your liking and then save it to some kind of like not temporary, but just some kind of like special place where it becomes a reusable block. Then you can manage the blocks in one spot. I just think that's such a cool use case that I bet that plugin already exists. I'm not sure what it is, but I bet it's out there.
Well, and I would too, like, you gotta get into some systems thinking, but like figure out like, oh, this is a repetition. Like on the sales page, it's not just this like big hero thing with like a custom graphic or SVG or something. But like just below that, we always do those three little like icon plus bullet point thingy. Like we always do that. So like you got to think like, okay, that's going to be like a, maybe I should spin that out into a Gutenberg block or something like that. I think to write Gutenberg blocks, you have to use React. Am I wrong in that? Am I mistaken, or is there an API now in like a functions.php you can write a block with? Is that?
I don't know. I don't know exactly. Like, can you write a Gutenberg plugin with just writing PHP only?
Yeah.
Yes, I think so, but I don't know.
Okay. I need to. We're going to redesign the Shop Talk site here, so maybe I'll get into some Gutenberg blocks. So
yeah, maybe. I just think if you want to do something really fancy and custom, you generally like do the JavaScripting yourself, you know?
Yeah, that's wild. So it's wild how it gets in there even. So anyway.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think, you know, I think Advanced Custom Fields has done some cool stuff too. Like you use an ACF block and then an ACF block is full of custom fields and that those things then are reusable. Like I think they stepped up to the plate and did some cool stuff with ACF and Gutenberg together.
Sweet.
That's all I got. All right.
Well, cool. Hey, we should wrap it up. Thank you. Dear listener, I hope you're having happy holly jolly holidays. We are going to take like 2 weeks off. We'll be back like the first week or whatever, first Monday-ish of January. So we appreciate you. I hope you have fun coding. I know I've got some little side projects bugging me here, so that should be a lot of fun. Or not coding. Literally throw your computer in a safe. That is also a good time. So
we have a couple of there's been a couple of lines coded to the new Shop Talk website. So it's real.
We've got
real.
At least 6 lines of code. So we're in good shape. Anyway, there's some tricky bits that we have been designed, and it's like I spend every shower like mapping it out, like trying to figure out how to like code it up. I don't know. Anyway, but yeah, so I hope you're having a good holidays. Don't delete us from your podcatcher because you'll need to know the website. The show gets back next year as we launch into another season. And if you hate your job, New Year is a good time to get a new job. Head over to shoptalkshow.com/jobs and get a brand new one because people want to hire people like you. And Chris, do you have anything else you'd like to say?
Shoptalkshow.com.